I'm Steve Riskin. I'm a senior program officer in the Institute's Grant and Fellowship Program, and I want to welcome you to this afternoon's session on negotiating with Iran. At the core of the Institute's mission are efforts to promote the peaceful resolution of international conflicts. There are programs to enhance the nation's capacity to prevent, manage, and peacefully resolve international conflicts, and there are initiatives to develop the knowledge and tools necessary to achieve those goals. USIP's work in this area as it relates to Iran cuts across and engages several Institute departments, whether it's the grant-making program, of which I am responsible, that supports Iran-related projects in research, education, and Track 2 activities, or the Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program, which this year has two specialists, Barbara Slavin and Avner Cohen, working on Iran-related research. And there's the Religion and Peacemaking Program that we have that has been involved in peace-building and bridge-building activities with American Muslim scholars and clerics with their counterparts in Iran. And finally, the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention that has been implementing Track 2 and other policy-oriented programs. In short, Iran is high on the Institute's agenda. Now, given that priority, USIP commissioned Ambassador John Limbert to undertake a study of Iranian negotiating behavior. The study will ultimately result in a book, but the focus of today's discussion is on an early product of John's research, and that is a USIP special report entitled Negotiating with the Islamic Republic of Iran, Raising the Chances for Success, 15 Points to Remember. Now, John's work is part of a decade-long USIP initiative on cross-cultural negotiation, an initiative that's produced several books and reports. The series now includes volumes on Russian, Chinese, and Japanese negotiating behavior, as well as studies of the way France, Germany, and North Korea negotiate, and finally an edited volume that is an analysis of the Oslo peace process and how Israelis and Palestinians negotiate. Now, you might have seen copies, display copies, out in the entryway, and those are available for purchase on our website, and of course all our special reports are available also on the website for downloading. Now, we are pleased to have with us today a diverse panel that brings broad experience and deep knowledge on Iranian affairs, U.S.-Iranian relations, and diplomacy. We will begin the panel with the report's author, Ambassador Limbert. John spent over 30 years in the Foreign Service, having won numerous State Department awards for his work in several key postings, including Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. He holds a PhD in history and Middle Eastern studies from Harvard and has published two books on Iran. He's fluent in Persian and has served in Iran. He served in Iran as part of an early attempt to rebuild American-Iranian relations following the Islamic Revolution in February 1979. He established contact with the new authorities and traveled widely around the country reporting on the realities of that rather tumultuous, chaotic post-revolution period, traveling widely, that is, until the takeover of the embassy when he became a hostage. And it was during that crisis that he gained some additional negotiating experience as a communication link between the U.S. government and the embassy captors. Now, John will be followed by Ellen Lapson, who is the president and CEO of the Stimson Center, where she also directs the Southwest Asia Project, an initiative that focuses on a range of security issues in the Gulf region. Ellen moved to Stimson after some 25 years in government service, including some very senior positions in the National Intelligence Council, the National Security Council, and the State Department. Among other assignments, Ellen was the special assistant to the U.S. Permanent Representative at the United Nations. And she has worked on much broader issues and global trends, but has focused a good portion of her career on analysis and policymaking on Middle Eastern and South Asian issues. Then we will hear from Michael Rubin, who is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and senior lecturer at the Naval Postgraduate School Center for Civil-Military Relations. He also edits the Middle East Quarterly. And between 2002 and 2004, Michael was the Iran Country Director in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He has a PhD in history from Yale University, where he focused his studies on Iranian and diplomatic history. He is author of two books about Iran and has published several journal articles relating to Iranian history and contemporary policy. Finally, we have Muhabbat Ahdiya, a senior Iran analyst at the National Open Source Center. He is a writer and researcher and analyst on Middle East issues, focusing on Shiism and governance, Iranian leadership dynamics, and the IRGC clerical relations. He was educated in Iran and the United States, and as his bio notes, he is descended from the lineage of 18th and 19th century Iranian scholars and reformers, including the Safavid era master calligrapher and scholar Ahmed Narizi. Muhabbat is currently conducting research on the roots and evolution of reformist ideas in Iran from the 19th century, focusing particular attention on the current debate among intellectuals and clerics in the Islamic Republic. Now, before beginning the panel discussion, I want to introduce Dr. Richard Solomon, the president of USIP. In addition to being the head of the institute, Dick was really the one who conceived and was the prime mover behind the institute's cross-cultural negotiation initiative. And drawing on his extensive negotiating experience with Beijing beginning in the early 70s and other negotiating experience, he authored one of the first volumes in the series, that on Chinese negotiating behavior. Dick?
Thanks, Steve, for that very good overview of what you'll hear today, and I don't want to take time away from what I know is going to be a very lively and very timely session. But let me make a few comments to put this presentation and our broader effort on cross-cultural negotiating behavior analyses in a little bit of perspective. Steve mentioned my own experience back in the early 70s. Henry Kissinger, for whom I worked for 5 years, was shocked when he started negotiating with the Chinese to discover that they weren't communists, that his experience had been dealing with the Russians, with Europeans, and what he and we all learned, I had had no direct dealings with Beijing. I had been trained in Taiwan and Hong Kong, but Henry discovered that they were very Chinese, and after 5 years of watching him deal with officials from Beijing when I had left the government, I tried to summarize that experience, and it drew on my own PhD-level training in political culture. And then what I discovered to my surprise was that our government does not train Foreign Service officers and negotiating skills. It does train them on how to negotiate within the interagency system. And one of the things you learn is that a relevant assistant secretary responsible for running a certain negotiation spends 90-95% of his time negotiating, trying to create an interagency consensus on what the negotiating position should be. And they really don't have anybody whose job is to figure out what is the delegation on the other side of the table going to throw at me? How are they going to try to entice me or pressure me into a deal that serves their interest? As Chaz Freeman puts it, our Foreign Service is really a mentoring system. They figure if a young Foreign Service officer is effective in negotiating his way through his career within the system, he must be a good negotiator, and that leads to a career in negotiating. So we felt, I suppose, given my academic background, that if we applied some scholarship to trying to summarize how different governments negotiate and then use them in our training work, that this would be a contribution to making our Foreign Service more effective in the primary tool of any diplomat, which is running a negotiation. And Steve mentioned the studies we've already done. He didn't mention one that we have underway, which I think is going to be very interesting, which is a study of American negotiating behavior. And last summer, we convened a dozen senior foreign diplomats to tell us how we've managed negotiations. That project is underway, but we normally think that we're ground zero and the people on the other side of the table, they're the different ones. But of course, negotiating is a dyadic process, and we bring our own cultural style to negotiations, and other governments are always adjusting and managing their dealings with us with respect to their sense of how we, in fact, manage a negotiation. So this project will evolve, and as the Institute's training activities expand, this will be an important element of it. And just as a final word, in the American political culture, negotiation is just an accepted way of trying to solve problems. We see it as normal. It's just part of the way our society works. We see negotiating as a problem-solving tool. But that's not always the case, and there are many reasons to negotiate, not just to solve a problem. If you're North Korea and you're under enormous pressure from China, from others, to resolve the nuclear issue in the six-party talk framework, but you really don't want to give up your nuclear program, maybe you go to the negotiating table to diffuse pressures, to string things out. You could find other reasons why one would go to a negotiation, not to solve a problem, but alliance maintenance is one of the arguments that we use now. Why bother to deal with North Korea if they're not really serious about cutting a deal? Maybe you do it so you maintain the six-party talk framework, which is an important way of constraining North Korea's actions. We'll, I'm sure, get off into that because many of these same issues are at play in dealing with the Iranians. So with those just opening observations, I just want to thank John Limbert and all the hard work he has done on this project. I think it's really very important. We have other studies that, unfortunately, we're behind the curve in looking at the Islamic world. We want to do studies. We have one we think we're going to get going on Pakistan, but we want to do Saudi Arabia. We want to do Egypt and fill out this growing shelf of books that I think will be quite important to making our negotiators more effective. So thank you again for coming.
Thank you, Dick. One housekeeping item before we begin, if you could turn off your cell phones or Blackberries or other handheld devices, they do have a tendency to interfere with the communications here. I've asked each of the panelists to speak for about 10, 12 minutes, and then after which we will open the floor for comments and questions. Ambassador Limbert.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dick, for those kind words. And I want to thank, first of all, let me thank the all of you for coming out today. I'm looking forward to hearing your ideas and to taking the draft and ripping it apart. It's rare in life you get a second chance, but we do. When this goes into the book, let me thank the friends here at USIP, particularly Steve Riskin and Shaul Bakash, who at George Mason, who helped me a lot with this particular draft. I also should thank special thanks go to Barbara Slavin, from whom I took on page 2 the metaphor about the adolescents at the prom. So thank you, Barbara. Thank you, Barbara. Let me also apologize in advance to my Iranian friends for any misreadings, misinterpretations, misunderstandings of their very rich history and culture, which may appear in this study. Iran has been a part of my life one way or another for probably about 45 years. As a teacher, a researcher, a prisoner, an on-the-street diplomat for about 10 weeks, a son-in-law, brother-in-law, and so forth, and so forth. All of these things, and I continue to make misunderstandings and misreadings of that absolutely fascinating and rich culture and history. In a way, this story begins with a monumental failure of negotiation. Back in October of 1979, somebody thought it would be a good idea to let the Shah into the United States for medical treatment. Despite, I must say, the very eloquent and well-stated advice of our chargé d'affaires at the time, Ambassador Bruce Langen, who told Washington in no uncertain terms what he thought about that idea. Washington listened to his advice, read his advice, and then did exactly what it wanted to do. As a result of that decision, about 12 days later, I found myself in the embassy outside our sealed door or our strong door, talking with a group of very unhappy young Iranians who had forced their way into our compound, insisted they had only wanted to have a sit-in, and my job was to negotiate them out. Well, as I said, it was a monumental failure. that negotiation, that experience. You all know what happened as a result of that. And I've often asked myself, you know, could I have done anything better that day? Was there something I was missing? What was wrong with my negotiating technique? I'm not sure. But this project has given me a chance and to sort of look at this whole situation in somewhat longer term. The result is what you see, and I certainly will look forward to the observations of our experts here and also to yours to make this to improve the final product. I'm going to be quite brief because I want to hear from the experts, but let me emphasize three points in here. Just direct your attention to three of them. This is 15 points. It could be 16 points. It could be 8 points. As it went through different drafts, it expanded and shrank according to what we did. But I would say, looking at this again, there are really three points that I want to talk about, just mentioned today. One is in point one, the idea that this is going to be hard, but it's going to be worth doing. And within that framework is the idea that in a negotiation, and it's particularly important, I think, in this negotiation, the important thing is check the sermonizing and the judgments at the door. As Roger Fisher, some of you know Professor Roger Fisher, who is sort of the international grandmaster of negotiation, as he would say, separate your view of the person from your view of the problem. Whatever you think of the person, the system, the government you are dealing with, that is one thing. Dealing with the problem is something else. Okay, that's one. The other thing I would emphasize is in point three, and that is the past matters. To be aware of Iran's history and how that affects what your counterparts will do and say. Let me just give you one very famous example. Probably many of you are familiar with this. In the summer of 1951, right after Iran had nationalized the installations of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which up until that time had a monopoly position over Iranian oil, in the resulting crisis, President Truman, seeing a serious dispute between two of America's friends, between the British and the Iranians, with whom we were both friends, asked Avril Harriman to go to Tehran and see if he could mediate the dispute. Harriman took with him as an interpreter Vernon Walters, because, interesting point, little side point, Mossadegh preferred to negotiate in French. Walters was a Walters, of course, was a superb French speaker. So he went as an interpreter. Mossadegh would not do these meetings in Persian because there was no interpreter that he could trust. So he preferred to do it in French. When the two of them met, Mossadegh turns to Harriman and says, "Mr. Harriman, you do not know the British. You do not know how crafty they are. You do not know how evil they are. You do not know how they sully everything they touch." And Harriman was taken by surprise, but he did not expect this level of vehemence from Mossadegh. And he said, Mr. Prime Minister, you know, we were allies. We fought a war together. I know the British. I know the British pretty well. There are good ones, there are bad ones, and some in between. And of course, that was not Mossadegh's point at all. Mossadegh couldn't have cared less about whether individual Britons were good, bad, or indifferent. He just looked at Harriman and said, "Mr. Harriman, you do not know them." And of course, what was he reflecting? He was reflecting decades, if not centuries, of British interference, semi-colonial control, patronizing, domination, some role of the British in Iranian politics and Iranian life, and it was all coming out in these statements. And I don't think Harriman was aware of it. I think Walters picked it up very quickly. Finally, I would direct your attention to point number 9. Give your Iranian counterparts credit for intelligence. You are dealing with smart people. They're not fanatics. They are not ignorant fanatics. Just as the Chinese were Chinese, the Iranians are Iranians. And give them credit for intelligence. And unfortunately, that hasn't always happened. There seems to be a tradition, and this isn't just us, of others treating the Iranians as though they really don't understand things. For example, go back to 1907. If you go back to 1907, the British and the Russians signed a treaty, an entente, in which part of it was to divide Persia, as it was then called, into spheres of influence. And they drew a line down the middle, and the Russians got the north, and the British got the southeast. And the preamble to this agreement says, "We are doing this in order to safeguard the independence and the territorial integrity of Persia." Well, I mean, how stupid can you think the Persians were? As some British observer said at the time, if when two great powers get together and say something like that, you know that some poor country is going to lose both its independence and its territorial integrity. Moving forward a little bit, in 1979, when the administration made the decision to admit the Shah for medical treatment, again, as I understand the decision process, it finally was, "Yes, we will do this, but we will tell the Iranians it is only for humanitarian reasons and only for medical treatment." Well, anyone knowing the history of U.S.-Iranian relations, British-Iranian relations, Iran's relations with the outside world over the previous 100 years would understand immediately that no Iranian, whether he is a monarchist, a leftist, a rightist, an Islamist, is going to believe that. Not one. And when you convey a message like that, which may well be true, from our point of view, it may well be true, but the impression that you have given to your Iranian counterpart is, we think you are very stupid. And so we are going to come up with the most absurd explanation that we possibly can. These are just, I just selected three. Maybe you had to go, down from 15 points to three. Those were the three I would select. Let me again thank you for coming out today, and I look forward to your comments and the comments of our experts. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm delighted to be here, and was really very happy to see this study, which I thought was a breath of fresh air to start to think about the path to a more normal relationship, or at least the beginning of an interaction with Iran that would be very different than what we've experienced for many decades. I also want to applaud Dick and others at USIP for this wonderful tradition of looking at negotiating behavior. I was familiar with the original studies on China and Russia a decade ago, and I'm glad to see that that tradition has continued and is finally reaching the Middle East region, where I think there's a lot of rich material to look at. And certainly the Arab-Israeli arena is ripe with negotiating experience, but some of the other larger Middle Eastern states would also be very useful to study more closely. I also just want to say that I've known John for many years, and it's perfect that he is the one to write this. When I think of how many people in the U.S. Government process have been somehow wounded by the Iran experience, and if more people had survived the crises of U.S.-Iran relations with the spirit and with the very positive attitude that John has always had, I think we'd be in a very different place. So I do value in particular the spirit and the kind of attitude and the philosophy with which John approaches this sometimes difficult problem. I think the first thing I'd want to say is that John's starting point is actually in a moment in time different than where we are today. I think we have to acknowledge that we are in the pre-negotiating phase, or even in an anti-negotiating phase, but we're not yet ready to totally absorb all of the lessons that he has to make. But it's very useful to get us ready for a moment that may feel a little bit different when people are willing to look at different approaches to Iran. I also appreciate he and others have and I also have associated myself with the notion that it is, of course, you know, never perfect to know when is the right moment and when does one make a gesture to in a relationship that is so fraught with misunderstanding and mistrust as the U.S.-Iran relationship. But what we do know is that all other approaches haven't worked. I mean, so we start from the premise, if the question is why negotiate, or on what are the conditions or the basis on which you think that negotiations might be productive or promising, I think the most powerful argument is that nothing else has worked. Punitive approaches, containment, coercive diplomacy have not produced the desired results. Now, that may not be a satisfying reason, but I think it is simply how we understand the recent history of U.S.-Iran relations. I wanted to also point out that it's not, John made reference to Mossadegh and to the hostage crisis and these deep wounds in the U.S.-Iran relationship that have so clouded the capacity of diplomats and people in power to try to think fresh about how to approach the relationship. My own recollection from my own time in government is it's not just those critical historic junctures where we really did bad things to each other, but it's also the recent experience of negotiations themselves. So it's the negotiations as well as the crises that loom heavy here. And my reference here is I was in the White House in the spring of 95 when President Clinton made two decisions about Iran, two executive orders to further tighten the sanctions against Iran. And the role that Warren Christopher played as Secretary of State was really quite striking. He was clearly deeply, deeply influenced by his experience negotiating the Algiers Accord with the Iranians, and really was still profoundly mistrustful of the Iranians. And I think that very much shaped his own policy recommendations and preferences that President Clinton then endorsed. And I recently heard Robert Gates in Bahrain for the Manama Dialogue gave a very tough speech on Iran, and he referred to the fact that he was in Algiers as some kind of a junior staff person in the delegation. And he also made very, very harsh judgment about how tough Iranians are and how difficult it is to negotiate with them. So that, unfortunately, it's not just that we've had these acute episodes of genuine crisis, but even the most recent experience of negotiations makes people wary of negotiating with the Iranians. I want to sort of run through a couple of John's very interesting points and combine a few of them because I think they play off of each other. On his important argument that history matters, well, I think this is a profound truth that Americans have to constantly relearn about virtually every part of the world. History always matters to other people more than it matters to us. We are uniquely ahistorical in our approach to foreign affairs, and it always puts us at a disadvantage because we never quite appreciate how alive the past is to other countries and other cultures. And so I think this is a very important point to make, and it will always be a point that we have to kind of make an extra effort to compensate for, because we just don't internalize our own history or the history of other countries as much as other cultures do. But I wanted to get to his point about grievance, and it seems to me that in other post-conflict situations that we look at, Arab-Israeli or South Africa, when we get to a peace process or a negotiation, we talk about the importance of establishing respect for the other person's grievance, or a kind of mutual empathy. And there's a lot of work that's been done in the conflict resolution community on how you get to this place where you acknowledge the pain that you may have inflicted or your country may have inflicted on the other party, and you express some recognition that this is real. It's a little bit hard for me to apply that kind of approach to the U.S.-Iran relationship, in part because it is, after all, asymmetric. I think that Iran can never mean as much to the U.S. as the U.S. means to Iran. And so that the Iranian need for some recognition of its grievance is something that we may not be able to satisfy. I think that there's a little bit of a disconnect there. And if we look at other reconciliation processes, there was more of an assumption of a mutual need to learn to get along and to coexist. And I think that is a little bit missing in this case, and I'd welcome John's reactions to that. Another sort of two points that John made that I wanted to pull together is remember that they're focused on regime survival and let them decide what their national interests are. Well, I'm trying to put this survival and national interest thing together because I think we've got regime survival, which is the survival of the Islamic Republic system, and then we've got national interests, which is about the nation state of Iran. And those two things are not necessarily the same. And I think that we have, and they're almost certainly not the same, and that certainly many Iranians would say that those are two very different things. And so I do think that it's important for the United States to focus on Iran's legitimate requirements as a nation state. We may silently and passively understand that the regime wants to survive, but I don't think it's our responsibility to assert that one of the goals of the negotiations is regime survival. So I think that we have to somehow differentiate that may be their agenda, but it's not necessarily ours. We do need to find a way to recognize the legitimate national interests of Iran. But I also wanted to raise the problem of is the Iranian negotiating partner only concerned with the nation state of Iran, or does Iran's government of today believe that Iran represents more than just the territory of Iran? To what extent is it a kind of a global actor, or believes that it represents some political force in the world that is challenging the status quo, that is revisionist? Here I'm trying to address Iran's ambitions to be a voice for a larger entity, that their interests are not necessarily just the traditional interests of a state, but do they have an interest in a broader political agenda, a set of values, Islamic leadership, some resistance against domination by Western powers? So I just throw that out as a question. Legalisms versus justice. I found this one very interesting because I think throughout our engagement in the Middle East, we learn that Muslim cultures and societies in general think a lot about justice, and that we do ourselves a great disservice when we don't show enough respect to the importance of justice, because justice is important to us, too. We could do more in talking about justice. This is an issue that's come up in our relationship with Iraq and with other countries as well. And here I appreciated John reminding us that, you know, culture really matters. I studied cultural anthropology. I deeply, profoundly believe that culture matters. But when we get to relations between nation states, we cannot be relaxed about legalisms. Legalisms are sort of the rule book of how nation states relate to each other. And Iran, a little bit, wants to have its cake and eat it too. It wants to be treated as a normal state, but it somehow wants to not be subjected to all the same rules as everybody else. It says we're different. And I think that the U.S. is profoundly about laws and the rule of law, and that is our culture. Our culture is rule of law. Now, we are wildly inconsistent when it comes to international law, but I still think that we have internalized in our own self-image that we care about law, and we certainly make lawyers very important in our society. But so I don't know how to square this circle. I do think that you have to find some common ground. I think we can show more respect for the themes of justice, and come to understand better what they mean and what their requirements are. But it does seem to me, if Iran wants to be treated like a normal state, and that would be one of the outcomes and one of their incentives to engage in negotiations with us, that we can't get around the reality that there are certain rules of how normal states behave, and this could relate to their support for terrorism or other things. So I don't want to completely brush aside the legal and legalisms question. John raised the important issue of who are the right people. Make sure you're talking to the right people. So he tantalized us with this important issue, and I want to push him, or at least ask him, if he can tell us what the answer to the question is. Not just tell us that there's a problem here, but what's the answer to this problem? What would happen if today, if next week or next month or next year, the Iranians agreed to meet us in Geneva and said, you know, we'll tell you who our delegation is, and then we learn that the delegation consists of, you know, second-tier diplomats that have no contact whatsoever with the Office of the Supreme Leader, people that are completely cut off bureaucratically and politically from where we understand real power resides. How do we begin a negotiation process when we know that this isn't the real power center? Does the U.S. have the right to say, we want to negotiate with the Office of the Supreme Leader? Or do we have to negotiate only with whoever the Iranian government says are their designated representatives? I know that in the diplomatic world, you negotiate rank. You can say it's going to be at the undersecretary level or it's going to be at the director general level. But given this dual system in Iran, what's the right answer to making sure that the right people are on the other side of the table? Two last points. You talked about grandstanding and theater and the performance aspects of negotiating, and also that power matters. And I think that both the U.S. and Iran fall into both of these traps quite often. Both sides have political requirements. You have to make sure that engaging with this, let's be honest, enemy or adversary, has to enjoy some level of political support and political legitimacy at home. And so you have to posture. You said, you know, leave the rhetoric at the door and, you know, don't grandstand. But the truth is both political systems require quite a bit of grandstanding to say, I'm not going to let them, you know, take me for granted. I know all the bad things they've done. And that certainly for our own, in our own domestic debate, it would be very important to sound very tough-minded, very non-sentimental in the beginning of a process of engaging with Iran. So we have to talk tough. And it is a conundrum. How do you get to that place of more appropriate negotiating tone when your domestic politics require you to somehow acknowledge the mistrust that exists? And on the power matters thing, I think this is profoundly true. And it is the source of the impasse. Neither the U.S. nor Iran ever want to begin a process when they perceive that they are the weaker party. And we see this again and again. We see it in the beginning of conversations over Iraq, that there's always this little dance that happens about whether one party is the demandeur and how do you get to a kind of mutually hurting stalemate, as Bill Zartman says, or a place where both acknowledge that they are neither strong nor weak, but they just need to take the next step. So I don't know how to square that circle either. And just one last thought. In addition to all the very constructive and useful things that John has offered us, I would look for one more thing that I think is necessary on the U.S. side that might be helpful to maybe something that the Iranians themselves want to hear. And this a little bit is in the category of regime survival national interest, which is at what point in this process can we acknowledge that Iran has legitimate security requirements, that Iran does worry about the security and well-being of its territory and its people, and that is separate from ideology, it's separate from political strategies, et cetera. And is there a way to change the dynamic between the United States and Iran by acknowledging that Iran has these legitimate security and national interests so that we can begin the negotiations when they happen, with a little bit less hostility? Thanks very much.
Thank you. I want to thank the USIP and also thank John for his very provocative and very useful report. It was a pleasure to read, and it was certainly one of those rare pieces in Washington that makes people think and think hard. So for those who haven't read the report in depth, I would certainly hope that they do so, whether they end up agreeing with it or not. My apologies before I begin. When you work in a think tank in Washington, all too often you're forced to do those 3 or 4 minute sound bites on television. And I came back into the green room once one was over, and there was a governor and his delegation there. And someone from the delegation said, "I thought you looked pretty good up there." And I said, "That's funny, because my sister always tells me I look fat, bald, and mean." And the governor looks up from his notes and said, "I didn't think you looked mean." So the point being, if I get intense, because this is a subject that I care about, it's not out of meanness. It's because I think this is one of the more important papers on Iran to come out of Washington, and especially out of the USIP in a while. What I really enjoyed about it, people know where I stand in terms of policy recommendations. I tend to look askance, or at least very cautiously, at some of the issues regarding negotiations. But my point here isn't to advocate for or against negotiations, but to respond to John's paper, and I do this in the spirit. It was a pleasure to read a paper that took into account culture and nuance to the degree which yours did. I'm going to go through some of the various points, not just the three which you had discussed. You had spoken a great deal about how there might not be a single intermediary, and failure might not be due to having chosen the wrong intermediary, or perhaps, I'll throw the contrary bit out, not choosing a proper intermediary or the wrong intermediary, however you want to put it. But I'm not so sure that it's an issue of a single intermediary here, and I'm not just talking about the binary or multipolar system of Iranian governance. In talking to, for example, people that have negotiated the Indian energy deals with Iran, one of the reasons why the Indian energy deals perhaps have been less successful in fruition than they have been on paper is because of a tendency of the Iranian negotiators or the Iranian state to negotiate by not adhering, but by utilizing the multiple power centers as an excuse to renegotiate or to renegotiate or revise existing agreements. And when talking to Indian energy negotiators who have a choice between, for example, Iranian gas and Qatari gas, it's interesting what they say in this regard. I'd also like to pick out a couple of the issues with regard to cognizance of the past, some issues which I thought might have been a little bit mutually exclusive or contradictory within the paper. There's an importance to being cognizant of the past, certainly, and Iranians, as many non-Americans, are quite cognizant of their history. People talk about how 1,000 years is a second, and a mile or 10 miles can be a million, where in many ways it's opposite in the United States. Anyone who's ever taught a freshman political science class or history class, if they start out asking the question, what's your earliest political memory, or asking a question about something that happened in the 1950s or 60s, you're going to be shocked at just how shallow some of the American political history cognizance can be, and yet Americans don't look askance at moving from Washington to California to New Orleans to Montana, as many people in the Middle East would look askance at moving so far away. However, this comes into the issue of pride and apology and weakness. You talked a little bit about power and weakness. Take 1953 and the example of Mossadegh. Just, I believe it was either February 2nd or February 3rd of this year, just this past weekend, in Asri Iran, the Iranian paper, they were reporting on the dispute that's arisen between the son of Ayatollah Kashani and the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting with regard to some critical comments which IRIB had made with regard to Kashani's role in the coup in 1953. And while we bend over backwards to be sensitive to the Iranians, in the case of 1953, while I certainly don't advocate or support, in retrospect, the CIA coup, it's interesting to note that the religious conservatives were perhaps in many ways on the same side as the U.S., and therefore, when giving an apology, as previous American statesmen have done, it raises a real issue as to whether that apology bolsters our position or signals some sort of weakness. And so I'd be very interested in hearing, I'm not arguing against the idea of having apologies, but in understanding when an apology is appropriate and when an apology is not appropriate for real or perceived past grievances. Now, you spoke a great deal about Track 2 negotiations, and that's a very important subject in your paper, about how to go back and forth unofficially about different people that may go and they have different agendas in their discussions and so forth. Track 2 negotiations have a positive and have a negative, and again, I think this is worthy of a special special attention, because there's a tendency in the U.S. to assume among many people, and you certainly don't do this, but many other people do, that it's always positive to have these Track 2 engagements. No harm can come. And yet, there also has to be the issue of parity. At the time of the Dialogue of Civilizations, at the height of it, if I may, around 1999-2000, when one compared the visa figures between those Americans who were able on U.S. passports to go to Iran and those Iranians who were able on U.S. On Iranian passports to come to the U.S., there was a discrepancy. I think about 800 American passport holders got visas, and about 22,000 Iranians got visas. Likewise, when the Track 2 talks are conducted within the academic community or within any specialized segment of society, the ability of that segment of society to represent the concerns that are the current concerns between two national governments as opposed to two peoples is incredibly important. I don't know any American who has gone to Iran who hasn't fallen in love with Iranian culture. Iranians are friendly, there's a great deal to the culture, but it's the guys with the guns that in many ways control the negative aspects of the interstate relations. And in this case, too many of the academics may go over whether it's the Clinton administration, whether it's the Bush administration, if they don't share the concerns of the U.S. administration, then on those items of concern, be it violent opposition to the Middle East peace process, be it some of the proliferation issues and so forth, that Track 2 negotiation is a useful exercise in people-to-people understanding, but I'm not sure whether it really, whether it advances the process in many ways, if it can't be a negative, if sometimes people allow themselves to be used for the other side's domestic political purposes in a negative way. Now, with regard to who we talk to. This really is the key issue. And one of those problems which I would identify now is the creeping, what I'd call it almost a creeping coup inside the Islamic Republic. When one looks at the biographies of Iranian parliamentarians, of governors, and other officials, there has not been a time where there has been more revolutionary guardsmen inside, in control, in positions of control in the Iranian government than there is now. The so-called Usul Gharian, the principalists, who came from the fronts and who have their own networks above and beyond the normal wire diagrams and power structures, which in Iran are confusing enough. And this raises a real question, that if the powers to be in many ways in Iran are the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, is there a special way in which we can deal with this? And it would add to what Ellen said in the whole issue of determining when we see who the Iranian delegation is, how we take into account these special networks, which are becoming more solid now than they've been in past years. I also would disagree with you a little bit on the issue of legalism and technical expertise. I've never found the Iranians to be shy of utilizing legalism when it's in their interest to do so, and they're perfectly capable of doing it. And we see this a great deal with regard to the diplomatic discussions over the Iranian adherence to the Safeguards Agreement, of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and so forth, and increasingly on some of the financial issues relating to the sanctioning of banks and so forth. Now, with regard to point nine, your point nine, which you had emphasized, giving credit to the intelligence of the Iranians. I'm sorry if I get the wrong number, but I too agree that it's important. One certainly shouldn't talk down. The Iranians are very smart. However, and frankly, compared to many other countries of concern or adversarial countries, I'd say the U.S. is extremely fortunate in, at the GS-14 level, the GS-15 level, senior people who might not otherwise have their names in the newspapers and so forth, from the days of the Peace Corps, from the days of the Foreign Service, there are many people who, whether they had positive political experiences or negative political experiences with Iran, are acutely sensitive to Iranian culture. I think during the Clinton administration, if I'm not getting the people confused, people like Dana Shalala were constantly seeking to play a role because of her past experience with Iran and Iranian society. And I think even among the so-called hawks within the U.S. government, that holds true. However, while people are sensitive to Iranian culture, at least people of a certain generation, and are sensitive to the fact that the Iranians are master tacticians, if you will. I mean, Ahmadinejad didn't get to where he is by being an idiot, and indeed, before he was president, one had his political control of the conservatives as they swept the local elections and so forth. Too often people focused on the Assembly of Experts elections when many more interesting patterns come out of the local elections themselves. But there is the issue of ideology in this case, and I wonder how that plays in. I would not suggest that the Iranians aren't intelligent or that they're crazy. They certainly aren't. But when we talk about the nuclear issue, for example, what always concerns me is who's in charge of that? What are the lines of control? What are the lines of command on some of these key issues, which will be major issues of negotiations should negotiations occur? When I hear the press and commentators and pundits talk about the Iranian nuclear program, it always makes me shudder, because is it really the Iranian nuclear program, or is it the Revolutionary Guard's nuclear program, or is it the Office of the Supreme Leader's nuclear program? And in that case, some of the perhaps fringe ideologies may come into greater importance. I mean, one of the ironies with Ahmadinejad in this case is by relying on populist religion, in a way it also becomes a strategy to bypass the more established clergy. I'll wind down now so that we can have the most discussion. One of those issues which I'd be very curious about would be the metrics. How do you judge sincerity? How do you judge success? Because there may come a point when too much negotiation undercuts that success if the negotiation becomes a delaying tactic on one side, if there's not sincerity. Let me end there because I'd say, I mean, there's a lot more we can discuss, and I look forward to having a very robust conversation. I do want to say that I remember seeing a Punch cartoon from 1907, which showed the Russian bear and the British lion both trying to pet the small Persian cat and basically tearing it apart,
right,
from the, I believe it was August 31st, 1907, or from the time of that Anglo-Persian convention. But I should just conclude by saying how much I look forward to reading your book as it comes to fruition, because I do think this is going to be a very important study.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
Mohabbat?
Well, it's great to be here in this distinguished panel here and this wonderful institution for peace. I can't imagine one could have spent time better than this being right here. Well, I don't know which one of the esteemed hostages was it who said this. I think from his experience dealing with Iranian students during that period, you may be able to point out which one, that one of the characteristics of Iranians is that they can actually hold contradictory opinions at the same time. And, of course, you refer...
Unlike the rest of us, right?
Yes, I should. And that added that, according to Mark Twain, that's a sign of intelligence, actually. So knowing that, and I can't remember the name of which one it was, but you may know, I would like to start first saying that this paper... is on the idea of negotiating with the Islamic Republic of Iran is done so well that there isn't really much more to add about how to negotiate as far as the principles are concerned. In fact, I think this is a subject that has the potential for winning a Nobel Prize for Peace, and I think John is ahead of everybody else when it comes to that. And in that, and so his 15 points are really excellent, so I wouldn't be adding anything to that, except adding, just mentioning some comments that may be useful in negotiating with Iranians. Of course, I have to add, after reading the paper, the magnanimous spirit of the author that comes through, that shows, despite enduring the suffering of being a prisoner, as you mentioned, in Iran, still writing a paper that is so balanced and so rational, and in many ways compassionate, is really extraordinary. And that's a sign of greatness of John himself and his ideas on this. Now, speaking of greatness, of course, it's important, and we all know, I think we have heard it a lot, so I would be very quick about that, about the greatness and achievements of Iranian nation, or Persia as it was known, its poets, philosophers, and some just rulers throughout the history have left a glorious heritage. We know that. In fact, in recognition of the potential for progress, one of its many wonderful poets said, and I just say this in Persian, it's quick, few words. I think John would feel good if I say that. Rasad adami be jawi ke be juz khoda nadanat. Mankind will reach such heights that only God can envision. And that was centuries ago, looking at the potential that exists not only in the people that this poet was looking at, but also people from other lands. We know one of the kings in Iran, the 6th century BC, Cyrus the Great, was immortalized by having his name mentioned with great honor in the Bible. And we know, I don't go into details of wonderful things that he did. We know the 10th century Ferdowsi, the great poet, actually foretold, predicted that Iran's greatness will come back one day. And that's very interesting, because his exact words is that the light of righteousness will proceed again from Iran one day in future. We are not there yet, but We'll get there hopefully one day. And then, of course, last but not least, the 13th century Rumi, the great poet who has captured the hearts of so many people in this country and many other countries. These are examples that we all recognize about the achievements of that that nation. But all of that said, and at this point I have to also add that I can't be as magnanimous as John, so hopefully that makes up for some of my harsh points when I go along about how to deal with Iranians. All that said, today we are not dealing with Rumi or Ferdowsi or Cyrus the Great. Indeed, we are dealing with what all of them and many other great minds in that land throughout the centuries clearly pointed out or knew was the problem in Iran. And that is the religious and political manipulation by the clerics. And this is not just about the Islamic period. This actually dates back to the time of Zoroastrian religion. In fact, one of the reasons Islam was so successful when it came to Iran first is because the Zoroastrian religion had declined so much as a result of activities of the clerics of Zoroaster. So it's not the Muslim clerics don't have exclusive ability to pervert the religion. In fact, these great minds in Iran were mostly victims of that, and they have mentioned it repeatedly in their poetry and in their writings, and warned people to be careful in dealing with them. But when it was not like that, when religion was not manipulated and degraded so much by the clerics, it achieved greatness, and it indeed contributed to the civilization. In fact, Iranians are very good at producing religions. I don't know if you have thought about that. I mean, Zoroaster and his great teachings, in fact, very few people probably would think of the influence of Zoroaster in many of the practices of Christian, Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist, and other religions and cultures worldwide. So they did influence all the cultures. Then Islam appeared, and they became instruments for greatness of Islam, because, of course, Arabs didn't have experience in empire building and administration of empires. So who helped them? Iranians again. So that helped with making the Islamic civilization. And believe it or not, they created two more religions in 19th century. That was Babi religion and Baha'i religion. In fact, Baha'i faith is now the largest religious minority in Iran and the second most widespread religion in the world. I mean, this is really Iranians can do well when it comes to producing religions. Now, these religions really do great when they come, and they contribute towards advancing civilization. The problem is when the affairs fall in the hand of religious leaders and they begin to use it for political purposes and other gains. Now, that brings me to this point I wanted to make in negotiations with Iranians. We have to be conscious and aware that there is a vast reservoir of religious and spiritual tendency in Iranian negotiators today. Now, it may be kind of unusual to hear of all the unfortunate corruption that is going on in Iran that is often attributed to Iranian leaders, but then think of them as religious and spiritual people. But, you know, compartmentalization, that can do wonders in the mind. Those things are separate things in the mind. You could be religious, and then necessarily you could be other ways too. And that is what is going on here. Now, the problem we have is that many of U.S. officials, when they sit down to talk to Iranians, they are not familiar and aware of the complex, especially Shia precepts and teachings that govern negotiations. In fact, there are books and long papers and journal articles that come out just about how to handle negotiations based on the Shia teachings. And there's no time to go into that. I just mentioned two basic things they often refer to as principles of foreign policy of Iran in their journals. One is Taghiyeh. You all have heard about that. I don't want to go into that. It's kind of compulsory misrepresentation of the facts when necessary. I mean, you are required to do that. I mean, all governments lie a little bit, but over there, it's compulsory. It's a principle. You have to do it for the interest of religion. And then Qat' al-Tariq is another one. It's a very important principle. That means in all your negotiations, dealings with foreigners, you have to constantly be conscious to make sure they don't have the upper hand, they would not gain dominance, and they will not rule over the faithful because they are infidels. All of that is constantly playing in the minds of people who are negotiating with American negotiators. Now, a combination of pride in the past, Iranian achievements in former centuries and ages, interpretation of Islamic teachings to allow jihad, even today, a sense of historical grievance over usurpation of their rights by the Sunnis, the other sect of Islam, and belief in ultimate victory through the appearance of a savior named Mahdi, or actually called Hidden Imam among the Shiites, together with the very establishment of the Islamic Republic. To them, it's a miracle. I mean, it was against all odds. And it was a divine hand that made it possible for the Islamic Republic to be created. So when they have all of that combined in their minds, it makes Iranian negotiators kind of a breed apart from anything ever seen. This actually, in this, I want to point the fact, because we often hear, rightly, comparisons that we have negotiated with Communist China and with many other adversaries. But you see, the difference is that Iranians are not like any other bitter adversary that the U.S. has had in the past. Because when you enter into a room to negotiate, and you have this, they call it falsafiya intizar, that means the spirit and philosophy of and hope and expectation for victory. It's supposed to be there always. And when you enter into that, time doesn't matter, how long it takes, 100 years, 1,000 years, that's all the same. And the ultimate victory is guaranteed. And so just take your time, make sure you have enough delays to achieve whatever else you have to do, and just go on that way. So that's what makes it so important to have incentives and disincentives for achieving results on time, and hallmarks, and specific time deadlines when you deal with the Iranian negotiators. And I'll get into that a little bit more later. But so religiously, and by extension in every other way, the hardline Islamic Republic officials today consider Iran to be, and that's another thing to be conscious of, what you use the term is Ummul Ghura. Now, Ummul Ghura is a title, ancient title for Mecca in Saudi Arabia. Literally, it means mother village, but in reality, it means center of Islam. So they refer to Iran as Ummul Ghura. They have replaced Mecca in their minds. Iran is the center of Islam, not Mecca anymore. And so they come into these negotiations with the idea that they represent the totality of Muslim nation, the believers, against infidels. In fact, I will get into that. The new national security advisor of Iran, Saeed Jalili, has papers and books, and some of it is available now in English. If you look at that, it's very important to know what he thinks, because he leads practically the foreign policy of Iran, as Mottaki is almost more of a decoration there. That what he says about negotiations, about dealing with the enemy, with the infidels, and how you relate to them. Now, in that view also, that Iranians bring to negotiations, here is what has happened. They have managed to interpret Islamic teachings and historical events to view Israel as a mortal enemy. That's given, it will never change, and that is it to them. And so we have to be aware that this is there, always in them. The West, especially America, is considered pure darkness. That's how they look at it, pure darkness. By virtue of its support for Israel and being an ally of Sunni governments. That's another grievance they have. Because historically, U.S. has been allied with the Sunni government rather than taking care of the rights of the Shiites that they think they are, has been usurped. In fact, if you look at the Iranian terminology, they try not to refer to Saudi Arabia. I was just mentioning to a friend, because they don't like that way to recognize the Saudi family. So they often refer to Saudi Arabia as Hejaz, you know, the ancient name for that land, rather than Saudi Arabia. So, in fact, if you go to the words of Khomeini himself, believe it or not, he said this. There are some surprising things even by Imam Khomeini. He said, "We may give up on Israel." That means settle our differences, but not with Hejaz. That is Saudi Arabia. So it's even more important to them than Israel, really, in many ways. That means, I mean, that is where Islam began. Obviously, that should be controlled by what is the center of Islam today, which is Iran. Now, the government has perfect control over a state, over the media, so it's a state media, essentially, in Iran. And so another problem we have, Iranian people really mostly don't know what's going on as far as negotiations are concerned. I mean, all indications are that most Iranians love everything American. A lot of what we hear about even 1953 coup and Mossadegh is, a lot of it is propaganda. In fact, Iranians mostly may be unhappy about what happened in 1953 and removal of Mossadegh, but clerics are not, I assure you of that. They have not shown any sign that that they're unhappy about that. So finishing, just in a minute, I cite Saeed Jalili, who says, negate all the friendship with infidels, he says, and he says that is based on Quran. He says, all infidels form one nation, and they are one nation, and we are one nation, dealing with them. And he says, we have to be equipped with various implements of defense, and presumably that includes nuclear weapons, because according to some Ayatollahs who are on the side of hardliners mostly, because you know religious clerics also divide into different camps, some of them have very openly have issued statements and fatwas, as they call them, about nuclear weapons, and they think that is actually has been approved in Quran when it said acquire the best weapon against your enemy, say the best weapon available today is nuclear weapon. So that's the interpretation. That's how religion can be interpreted, right? And it's unfortunate, but to mean things that are not necessarily good. But anyway, I want to just end by saying that the most important thing is for U.S. negotiators to consider the plight of most Iranians today. I think Alan mentioned that to distinguish between Iranian kind of Islamic Republic government and the state of Iran and Iranian nation. Most Iranians are suffering today at the hands of the same people we are trying to negotiate with them. That's the students, women, labor population, ethnic and religious minorities, especially Baha'is. That persecution is going on as we are sitting here, or standing here in my case. And that is what we need to consider the interests of Iranian nation. Already, and this is the last thing I would say, the reformers in Iran are saying a deal has been struck between the U.S. and hardliners in Iran. And they think the reduction of violence in Iraq and the fact the hardliners just rejected practically all reformers for the election in March for the Majlis is the outcome of a deal that has left hardliners free to do whatever they want, and as a result they are sacrificing the reformers in Iran. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, each of you, for your insightful, colorful comments. And I don't know, John, did you want to take a moment to respond? Sure, and then we'll open the floor up for questions.
Sure, thanks.
First of all, let me thank my friends here for some insightful comments. You probably noticed I was taking a lot of notes, and I think the next version will be better. Thanks to your contributions. Are any of you familiar with a wonderful Iranian practice known as Taaruf? Yeah. Basically, that's what my friend Mr. Ahdieh did in praising something. You know, so when someone writes a poem and they say, "Oh, this we have never seen such a great poem." Since the lips of Hafez were stilled forever, and this is wonderful. Actually, this is a very it's amusing in some ways, but it's very serious because it's a way of how would you say softening interactions in sometimes a very harsh environment. Just a couple of observations. I'm speaking of the coup of 1953 and the I think Alan mentioned the coup and then the events of 1979 as being the sort of mutual wounds that we have inflicted on each other, or at least seen as such. I was doing a program a few weeks ago, a few months ago now, on the anniversary of November 4th, and of the takeover. It was a call-in show at Voice of America TV, Persian TV. And people call in. I mean, they call in from Iran, and they express their opinions very, very freely. And someone called in and said, "Look, it's been 28 years now. Is it time that you Americans get over this? I mean, it's finished." And I said, "Yeah, I'm happy to do that. That's quite all right. What about the 1953 coup?" And he said, "Never." Never happened. Never happened. On the visa figures that you gave, Michael, those are very interesting. What they suggest to me is not that necessarily the track two exchanges were one sided. Maybe they were, but what I would guess, my guess would be that of those 22,000 visas, probably 21,000 of them had nothing to do with Track 2 and a great deal to do with the Tehrangulus Iranian community, because they're one of the side effects of the Iranian revolution has been to bring this enormously talented group to our country. I often think that what we should do is at some point the president, maybe in answering Ahmadinejad's letter, remember this letter that he wrote to the president last year, should write back officially thanking him and the Islamic Republic for all the talented scientists, engineers, space people, computer people, entrepreneurs, university professors that Iran has sent to us. It's truly amazing. And then the back and forth is there's a lot of back and forth and a lot of traveling. And finally, I would say one thing to look at, how do these things go on? We've mentioned people mentioned apologies, people be recognizing, but I would agree with what Alan said. I think the issue is not so much who apologizes for what, but who empathizes, who understands, who at least says, okay, there is a grievance, who recognizes the grievance. And I think there's a problem on both sides. In our case, often it's just we don't know about it. Who remembers what happened in 1953, or who cares about what happened in 1953? But I would say, for example, the same day I was speaking at the Voice of America, the Iranians were marking the embassy takeover with celebrations on the streets of Tehran. Now, you could say they were staged, they were this, they were that, but even so. I mean, can you imagine sometime in the United States that we hold celebrations to celebrate August 19th, 1953? Or, God forbid, the shooting down of the Airbus in July of 1988. I mean, there's a long way to go on both sides. But maybe the first step in this negotiation, and incumbent on both sides, to do this, is this empathy and this recognition. So, thank you. I look forward to comments from the audience.
If there are microphones on each side, so please line up, and if you could give us your name and affiliation, that would be helpful. Yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Murad Ekbal. I am at the University of Baltimore Center for International Comparative Law. I would like to thank all panelists and the Institute for putting on a program like this, which is very timely. And as I was listening to all four, I was wondering how long it would take before we would get to Cyrus and we would get to thinking about what has happened in the past. The remarks from my particular and personal vantage point tend to look too far back into the past, and you never negotiate backwards in time, you always negotiate forward in time. So my suggestion, if I may, is to point the panelists and the audience to two important factors, I think, that might help establish a dialogue. The first one is that the demographics of the 1979 and 1960s has completely changed in Iran. You're looking at a new generation that, by and large, and I know that from personal experience with those that I've been in contact with as an educator, are in fact looking to the United States, would want a dialogue, would want a discussion. And that community is not being included. Now, whether we include them by instant messages, text messages, internet, PDAs, and what have you nowadays, which they all, by the way, have in Iran, I don't know. But it's a community that should be included in our dialogue and isn't. The second one, and myself included, is a whole group of Iranian by birth, that is what I am, who spent a substantial portion of their life, both as adolescents as well as adults, outside of Iran, but have very deep roots. Not unlike one of your speakers, I have a very deep familial roots on both my father's and my mother's side to Iran. And that community is outside of the country and is not being included in that dialogue. And they have no particular axe to grind one way or the other, but they represent a very powerful and important group globally that, if engaged in this dialogue, could be very beneficial to reduce tensions. Thank you.
Take one from over here.
Yes. On the one hand, Wayne Zaidman, I'm a retired FBI agent. On the one hand, you have an Iranian population, largely young, largely supportive of Americans and our ideals. On the other hand, you have a government regime which is largely controlling the courts, the newspapers, the police, the security services, which is heavily influenced by the Revolutionary Guards. So, and as a result, in the last couple of elections, they've stopped people from becoming candidates because they're not eligible. They're not, you know, they push the reformers out of the government. So my question to you, anybody in the panel, is what can we do to help the silent majority in Iran who want change but are not in a position to get it right now?
Let me make one point very quickly. Again, at heart, in the interest of full disclosure, at heart, I'm a medievalist, I'm a historian. And the situation that you mentioned for Iran, the distance between the ruled and the rulers, is not new. Iranians, unfortunately, I mean, as wonderful and great, as wonderful and as rich as their culture is, their history is a very tragic one. And it's one of misrule, often misrule and brutality. And what Iranians have had to become expert in is dealing with that, dealing with a group of thugs, fanatics, and bigots who happen to have the power. How you change that, how you deal with that, all I would say is, I don't know. I would love to hear if someone has an idea, but you do it very carefully. Although Iranian, you know, young Iranians that you say, they're very talented, they're very impressive, they've gotten very well educated, but they're also very, I suspect, they're also very patriotic and might not welcome some change imposed from the outside.
Just very quickly in answer to your question, and it doesn't just affect Iran, I'd say it's a factor in much of the Middle East, is I would argue we need to better differentiate between NGOs and gongos, the so-called government-operated NGOs that, in newspaper articles, in our own Track 2 in the negotiations and so forth, we have to recognize that not all NGOs are truly non-governmental. The second issue, which is fascinating and I don't think it gets enough attention in the U.S., is the whole issue of the struggle for independent labor unions in Iran as opposed to government to operate on pseudo-governmental labor unions. And this has come to a fore with the bus drivers in Tehran. And the last thing, which I think you brought up a very important point with regard to the social networking sites. I mean, Facebook has taken off in the United States, Friendster before that. And in Iran, with regard to some of the homegrown social networking sites, they're facing many of the same problems that have been getting much more publicity in China and so forth with regard to the government simply trying to shut them down and breaking out of that bubble. But in my opinion, in answer to your question, breaking that government monopoly over communication is always going to be key.
I'll just add a short comment. You already heard the sufficient complete answers here. But I think the potential of internet, satellite communication, even cell phone, has not been used very well in, as you mentioned, that silent majority to reach them. And I think we need to improve in that area. You're not doing a good job at all in trying to use this modern information and communication technologies to reach larger number of Iranians.
Barbara? Yeah. Barbara Slavin. She's the person I mentioned in my introduction, senior fellow here at USIP.
Thanks, Stephen. And John, thank you very much for acknowledging the prom analogy about the U.S. and Iran. I wanted to ask about two aspects. One is the who do you talk to and how do you start the negotiating process. In 2005, 2006, there were overtures from the current Iranian government for back-channel talks with our National Security Council. And there was a proposal to have a deputy Iranian National Security Advisor meet with a deputy of Steve Hadley to start to prepare an agenda for talks. The proposal was rejected by the Bush administration at the time. Is that an appropriate way, given all the difficult issues? Do we need a sort of Shanghai communique that's negotiated through back channels before there's an acknowledged beginning of proper negotiations? And then a question about who we talk to. Ellen pointed out, in 1995, we slapped comprehensive sanctions on Iran, which hadn't existed before. We've seen under the Bush administration a continuation of this process where we have sanctioned banks, we have sanctioned individuals, including many members, commanders of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. Given the importance of the Revolutionary Guard in Iran now, as Michael Rubin pointed out, are we cutting off our nose to spite our face? Are we sanctioning some of the people that would have to be party to any realistic negotiations, especially if they dealt with the nuclear program and if they dealt with Iran's support for militant groups in the Middle East, since, as we know, the Quds Force of the Revolutionary Guard is the vehicle by which Iran supports those groups? Thanks.
Well, I think that, there is a choice to be made, that we can go the sanctions route, which we've been doing for a really long time, which is isolating anybody in Iran whose behavior we find unacceptable, or there's this negotiating path. I don't think there's a logical... I do think that we, obviously, if we were to get to a more, over time, we could negotiate the retraction of sanctions in exchange for some kind of a political engagement, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Iranians have some expectation of that if they continue to cooperate in the Iraq channel, and that the Iraq channel could then lead to some wider discussion. But, I think there's a different logic to sanctions than there is to where John is trying to get us. I think John is trying to get us to saying, all that punitive stuff hasn't produced the desired results. We, here, let me come back again, rule of law, it's not easy to lift sanctions. It's not easy in our own political culture to decide that the criteria have been made or to override them and say, for national security interests, the president's going to decide that he doesn't really want these sanctions anymore. So I think they represent two different logics, and I think it's very tricky how you move from one path to the other.
Yeah. And in terms of back channel, where did that
It may well be. I mean, at the end of the day, when there's the will to talk, if it's done, it will go. in whatever channel. I mean, I'm reminded. Someone mentioned Warren Christopher, and I'm reminded when he finally was able to start negotiations over getting us out of Tehran. It was an approach through the Germans. To an Iranian official, and as I remember this, and I go back to the reference, Deputy Secretary Christopher, I think, he asked for sort of a sign to ensure that the person he was talking to was in fact legitimate. And the person said to him, "Look in Khomeini's next speech, he will make a reference to something." And he said the secret word, whatever it was. But there it was. So I mean, whether the channel was up here was a high level one or a low level one or a medium level one. At the end of the day, didn't matter as long as that side was connected to something. And unfortunately, some of the other efforts and some of the efforts we've seen, you know, in the meantime have been people with other motives. One of the things I've said in this, and it was maybe a little bit flippant, but I said, be very careful of people who come to us presenting themselves as intermediaries, particularly if they say, "I don't want anything for myself." I said, if you hear that, that's a sure sign to run the other way as fast as possible.
If I may just add quickly, I mean, your words were as fluid as Hafez's, but I'm kidding. One of the broader points which I think needs to be addressed is the issue of timing. One of those issues which we have seen, regardless of the who, what, and when of the various outreaches to each other, the various negotiations which have occurred, especially since Ahmadinejad came to power, is the sense, and we're seeing it in the Iranian press, that you reformists, you Mohammad Khatami, you didn't achieve anything, and yet now under us, under my strategy, under Ahmadinejad's strategy, the Americans are coming to the table. The Americans are offering this. Mohammad Khatami, you were never able to come to the United States, to Washington, during your administration, and yet now, because of my Holocaust denial, because of my saber rattling, you're welcomed, and therefore it's almost like a perverse Groundhog's Day if timing isn't taken into account, that we're saddled with, I mean, hopefully not, six more decades of winter.
I'm Gareth Porter, independent historian and journalist. I'd like to take off on the general theme that we've just been discussing, which is who are we going to be talking with, and what do they represent? And just to take off from the last comment by Michael Rubin, the whole question of the fact that Khatami has been discredited in Iran, as certainly it's been widely reported. Why is that? Why is it that his policy toward the United States has been discredited? It's because the U.S. policy was simply gave him the back of their hand in 2003. That's not the only case, unfortunately. Rafsanjani tried to do something much earlier in the early 90s. He specifically had cooperated with the United Nations to ensure that the hostages in Lebanon would be returned to the United States and Britain. And it was understood very clearly by the Iranians, because of the UN envoy, who was the intermediary, that the U.S. government would respond with their own gesture of goodwill. That didn't happen, of course, and according to the reports we have, it was not for very good reason. It was internal politics in the United States. So my question really to the panel is, hasn't U.S. policy in the past, by taking a hard line, In large part because of U.S. politics, but not exclusively, haven't they managed to discredit those people who were either pragmatists, realists, or, in the case of Khatami, arguably reformists, in their effort to take an accommodations line towards the United States? And what are the lessons of that for the next administration?
just start a few words?
Go ahead.
Well, one reason many of these attempts have not worked with Iran is because of, I'm sure you're aware of the parallel institutions in Iran. In fact, when we talk about Iranian government, we have to be very careful exactly what we mean. It's not just like any other government. I mean, when you say government, do you mean the president and his cabinet? Yes, maybe. But there are so many other institutions much more powerful than president and his cabinet. And so if tomorrow Iranian president wants to negotiate with the U.S., that does not mean necessarily that it's the Iran Islamic system that is ready to negotiate with the U.S. Identifying who really has the power to proceed with this and do that, I mean, one of the obvious things is to make sure that Khamenei himself is involved in this, but how would you do that? Ensure that Khamenei's office is behind the negotiations. In fact, a lot of negotiations, often the value of one of the ways to increase the chances is to keep things secret. Now, in Iran, they have taken it to an extreme level. It is so secret that it's almost denied that, for example, the current negotiations in Iraq, it's not called negotiation. Most of the time, it's called, the terms used for it is tafhim et-taham. That means we are out there to give legal notice to Americans that they are guilty. That is the term used, tafhim et-taham, that we are not negotiating with them. We are giving them the notice that they are guilty. So it's a very sensitive issue. There are a lot of background to this. Khomeini said no negotiations ever. He left a little window open somewhere. I've seen in his writings. But on the other hand, the conflict, the rivalry, the factional infighting is so intense in Iran that I'm not sure there is a way to really exactly identify who you can talk to that you would get results at this point.
I'm intrigued by the analysis that the U.S. perhaps unwittingly has undermined the reformers at various points. But my own recollection of Khatami's weakness is a little bit different than that, and that is that, you know, when Khatami became president, the reform movement, they were first-time parliamentarians, they were not very adept at pushing a new legislative agenda in the Majlis, and that they were disappointed and actually felt a little bit almost betrayed that Khatami took seriously his role as president of the republic of all Iranians, and that he no longer saw himself as the leader of the reformist faction, so that they were without a leader. I mean, I think there are internal domestic political dynamics in Iran that would explain Khatami's chronic weakness. Perhaps we could have done more for him, but I think he was also nervous. And I also think just what Mohabbat just described, that I think any perception that an Iranian leader is about to accumulate so much power, including a seal of approval from the United States, creates a physics reaction in Iran where other Iranian actors will undermine that person. So it's not that the U.S. wittingly or intentionally undermined, but I think that even the prospect that this person is going to be embraced as the breakthrough figure by the United States would create a reaction to that person.
There's a curious feature that's run through at least recent Iranian history, going back quite a ways, going back well before the revolution, and that is there seems to be a prevailing conventional wisdom in Iran. There seems to have been that we will get a better deal from the Republicans than from the Democrats. And I don't know why. That may go back to the Shah's better, you know, feeling closer to the Republicans. At his time, he had a very difficult relationship with John Kennedy. I am told this is one explanation why, when Secretary Albright made her offer of talk of the roadmap and the talks without preconditions at the end, near the end of the Clinton administration, it was one explanation for why the Iranians did not respond more positively, thinking we can wait. There may be a Republican administration coming in. The Republicans are oil people. They're business people. They understand. That's right. They understand these things. And there was that speech as well. But there are different explanations. But what that's one. It's a curious, you know, it's a curious thing, but it seems to be out there.
We have about 15 minutes and six or seven questioners, so I would ask that you be brief and to the point. Daniel Brumberg.
Yes, thanks very much for a very interesting conversation. I remember back to my second trip to Iran. I was interviewed on national television, and the interviewer said to me, "What do the American people think of Khomeini?" And I just froze. And how you answer this might influence how you get out or you don't get out. And I thought, well, this is extraordinary. This fellow thinks that every morning American people get up and they think about Khomeini. And who's, you know, talk about projecting your own neurosis or something else onto somebody else. I mean, this fellow probably got up every morning and thought about the United States and Khomeini. And I think there is a ideological and cultural dynamic to dealing with the Iranians that is very special, and I don't think we can ignore it. I do think it's important. I think two factors need to be kept in mind, and I would offer these to Ambassador Lindbergh, whose earlier iterations of your piece I did read. And that, of course, is we have to distinguish between culture and ideology. They are not the same things. And the Iranian Revolution was a multiple ideological event with different factions of having different ideologies. And that gets to this whole question of factionalism. They're very different perspectives. Now we're dealing with the purists, what they themselves call the fundamentalists or the rootedness. And it's a very different dynamic than it was a little while ago in that sense. But the other question I have is a sort of more academic question that I'd like any of our panelists to address. I think Ellen alluded to it, and that is, we all agree that culture matters, but when does it matter? Under what circumstances is it important, as opposed to the rational incentives for people to negotiate? I mean, what is really crucial here to get people to negotiate? How much weight are we going to attach to culture, and when? And how do we know when to do it? I don't think that one can, to be honest with you, address this kind of question without sort of thinking deductively about sort of these issues. Now, and moreover, I would ask the following question. In our relationship with Iran, when, particularly over the last 10 or 15 years, have we been in a position to test the importance of culture? Have we reached a point, the mutually hurting stalemate or whatever you want to call it from a rationalist perspective, by which we can actually demonstrate that culture really mattered? Or have we simply not arrived at a point on either side, for reasons that may be in large part rational, that by which either side decides that there's an incentive to negotiate and has an incentive to negotiate? I think this is a crucial, the fundamental question to sorting out when culture matters and therefore what are the policy implications of culture in negotiations.
Okay. Point taken.
I would say when we talk about culture, of course, I mean, point well taken, correct in your comments. It's not just the artistic side of that society. As you know, in Islam, practically everything is lumped together in religion. So it's culture, it's politics, it's social interaction, it is habits, it's the parties people get together. A lot of these things are related. So I guess that when you address them, you emphasize the importance of culture, you mean really the totality of the personality of that negotiator with that country.
Just, I thought it was a very good intervention. The flip side of that, and something I certainly look forward to reading in your book, is the whole issue of projection and how Americans, the flip side of culture is making sure that we don't siphon our own views artificially, and this especially in a more pragmatic case, is often the case, not so much with the State Department, which is widely exposed, but sometimes in the DI, where people's experience, especially in a country like Iran, where they haven't had the opportunity to travel, is largely book knowledge. But in listening to Professor Brumberg's intervention, I'm also reminded of a quip I heard from a U.S. general relating to the question about how do you know when culture is important, and his answer was, unfortunately, when we're doing the after-action report.
Why don't we take a couple of questions from that side, too, and then we'll shift. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Fariba Amini, and with all due respect to Ambassador Limton and Bruce Langen sitting here, and as someone whose father was Prime Minister Mossadegh's, and he's still living, Prime Minister Mossadegh's personal attorney and mayor under his premiership, I must distinguish between the taking of the hostages in Iran and changing the course of a history of a nation. There is a huge difference. And unfortunately, to this day, you talk to any Iranian, and maybe it's unfortunate, but we also always go back to 1953 because we had a democracy, and the British and Americans brought that democracy down, and we have now a theocracy, and before that we had a dictatorship. So I would like to make that distinction, even though I actually publicly in a place on behalf of Iranians apologize to Mr. Langan for having him as a hostage in Iran, although I had nothing to do with it. But this is my and I want to go back, actually, if I may, to a quote that I think it's maybe a little bit understandable for Iranians, that was written in 1993, but it goes back to 51. The British, determined to undermine Mossadegh from the day he was elected premier, refused to negotiate seriously with him. For instance, Professor Lambton, serving as Foreign Office consultant, advised as early as November 1951 that the British government should persevere in undermining Mossadegh, refuse to reach an agreement with him, and reject American attempts to find a compromise solution. She said, "The Americans," she insisted, "do not have the experience or the psychological insight to understand Persia." And the reason I'm bringing this, this is from a long time ago, but I just sometimes wonder, if you want to negotiate with someone, anyone, and especially with, you know, a regime that is, yes, we are against this regime. As an Iranian, I am against its abuses and all that. But if you want to negotiate with regime, do you go constantly banging their heads against the wall, bringing down their culture, bringing them down in public, in the press, in the media? I'm not talking about you, the several people who are sitting here or this, but we're talking about CNN and all these other propaganda machines who are... Iranians do not believe that America really wants to negotiate with its government. And you should, in my opinion, you should ask, even though it's very hard to negotiate with this government, what do you want from America? Maybe that's the first stepping stone.
Ms. Amini, thank you for your... for your intervention. I'd like to send you the draft of my chapter on the Mossadegh era, because there's some interesting lessons there. The point, of course, I don't disagree with anything you say. It's a question of perceptions and how these events affect perceptions on both sides, rightly or wrongly. But it's very interesting. One thing that Khomeini was very fond of saying, and many people still quote, is they say, why should we negotiate with the United States? What do the sheep and the wolf have to negotiate about? And what he's getting at is a kind of base of inequality, when such an inequality exists. And the history, again, that's why I say, maybe culture doesn't matter so much, but history sure does. And one of the lessons of 1951-53, as you said, was that you had two sides negotiating, but one of those sides knew that it didn't have to negotiate. It could upset the whole table. It could turn over the chessboard anytime it wanted to. So, and that that's why I say history matters. That history and the attitude affects what we see today. So I thank you for making those points.
Okay, what I think I'm going to ask you to do is state your questions, and let's just go through the last four, and then we'll give the panelists an opportunity to comment because we're getting near the end. Yes?
Sanam Naragi Andrelini. Four very quick points. Number one, are you going to do an honest critique of the U.S.'s responses to Iran following what the previous speaker mentioned? Because I think that there is a misperception about here in the U.S. about U.S.'s responses to Iran at various points over the last 30 years. Number two, why are we keeping our focus on the history? We have to look at the region now and in the future. This is a pretty dangerous region, and actually, if you look at it, Iran is the one society which is post-Islamic militancy. It's the one stable country in the region, and I would think that there's a lot of room for real room for bridging and collaboration with the U.S. So, you know, the history is a history, but moving forward, I think, would be very important. And related to that is the question of sanctions. You mentioned the question of the state versus the nation. Ask any Iranian that's out there on the street, if the sanctions go, the system will change. It might seem as a short-term gain to whoever's in power, but actually the society is ready to make those changes, and by keeping the sanctions, we're just maintaining the hardline pressure. And my fourth point in this question in terms of negotiations, why not have a big tent? Have all, you know, reach out. Khamenei said, come and talk to me. But why not have multi-party talks on both sides, having everybody there so that it is transparent to all sides? And whatever agreements are reached, nobody can undermine the other because they weren't there when the agreement was reached. This has been the history of the Iranian side, certainly. When Khatami made the gestures, the hardliners didn't like it. Now the hardliners seem to be gaining and the reformers don't like. Bring them all together. The same here with the Democrats and the Republicans. Something a little bit different, a little bit new. Thank you.
Okay, let's take those comments and we'll get your question and we'll get questions here and then wrap up.
My name is Rudy Mate and I'm a historian and my specialty is early modern Iran. And I look at this panel and I read the paper and I think it's a fascinating paper and it makes some references to history, but when I look at this whole discussion, especially the talk by Mr. Ahdia, neither religion nor the semi-colonial history of Iran really matters, in the sense that neither really goes back to the root cause of the problems, the intricacies of having to deal with Iran and the frustration that it constantly evinces. When I look at my period, the Safavid period, 1500 to 1722, and I've worked on this and I've published on this, you know, the discussions between the Dutch in the East India Company, the English East India Company, long before colonialism, they are faced with exactly the same problems. So I don't want to generalize, you know, and sort of pull out national characteristics, but the same, you know, complication, the same plausible deniability, the same utter refusal and inability to take responsibility, the constant referral to the real source of power, the Shah. As long as the Shah is really not just in power, but also willing to take power, things get done. But usually that's not the case, because the Shah is ultimately not just the apex of power, he's also in the middle of the vortex of power. So he is a faction among all the other factions, albeit the most important one. So exactly the same issues. And I think when you write the book or finish the book, I think it would be good to go back, at least certainly to that period, to look at some of the continuities involved.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Diane Perlman, in addition to culture matters, history matters, that also psychology matters, trauma, fear, humiliation. And while we're analyzing the Iranian negotiating style, we also mentioned the American negotiating style. And Ellen, you mentioned that there's a lot of coercion, threat, sanctions. There's a body of literature on sanctions, which 85% of times make things worse. There's also a body of literature on apology and how that often helps the situation. And instead of looking at their style, I think it's important for us to look at the effect of our style on their style, and also provoking extremism. You know, you say, oh, look, they're extremism. But when we, when they reach out to us in 2003, help us with intelligence, candlelight vigils in 2001, and then we call them the axis of evil. And whatever we're talking about now, Bush is still using very harsh rhetoric and talked to Armat like we don't believe the NIE, and still making threats, that's going to affect their style, and also attention to tension reduction. And, and I mean, gender is also an issue, but that's a whole other category. And I think we get engaged in what I call self-fulfilling paranoia, where we're afraid and then we react and then we provoke their fear and we keep ratcheting up.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
My name is Ali Nader. I'm from the Center for Naval Analysis. And with all due respect, I wonder if one of our key assumptions is faulty, and that is that the Islamic Republic wants to even negotiate with the U.S. If you look at their foreign policy, their ascendant in Iraq and Afghanistan, they're aiding anti-U.S. insurgents, killing American troops, essentially, harassing our ships in the Gulf, proceeding with their nuclear enrichment. So I wonder, if we talk about negotiation, if we reach out to them, negotiate, if they see that as a sign of weakness. And another comment on culture is, we talk about culture and that we have to keep in mind Iranian culture, but when we talk about the Islamic Republic, it has a different set of cultural values. It's a clerical culture that's very different than Iranian culture. And a lot of Iranians do not relate to that, so
Okay.
Thank you. Why don't we take those questions and make final comments from each of you? John, would you like to start?
Again, thank you. Thank you for those. I've taken a lot of notes. I have a lot of food for. You've given me a lot of food for thought. On this, just on this question of sanctions, pressure, talk tough, whatever works. I'm reminded there's a famous statement. I don't know where it came from, but it goes around a lot, and you hear it a lot. And someone says, remember, when you're dealing with Iranians will never give in to pressure. They will only give in to a lot of pressure.
Well, I just follow up confirming that. In fact, going back to 2003, and because it seems like there were some movements in that year, we have to remember what was going on in 2003. In fact, if you look at the statements made by Hassan Rouhani, the former chief nuclear negotiator, he had to, because he's under attack, I mean, the reformers, in defense of himself and reformers, he recently said, only if you were aware how besieged we were, how threatened we were, you would understand why we did what we did. So with that, this idea of a lot of pressure, that is something that should be considered in any formula that is followed.
In response to the last question, I don't think that John's study is premised or needs to be premised on the notion that both parties are ready today. I think to the contrary, he's created a sort of artificial construct of when they might, at that time when they might be ready, here's things to bear in mind. So I don't think that this study necessarily can address all of the history of U.S.-Iran relations or every Iranian reaction to every American reaction, but I assume to every American policy, but I assume there'll be room for some history in this interpretation. But I do think that my own sense is that this exercise is a little bit different than that. It's not suggesting that now is the moment, but it's a little bit different. I do appreciate, in addition to culture and history, that psychology and dealing with, the grievance, et cetera, unfortunately, this is different historical moments in terms of when the grievance, when the grievance has happened, and that can over-personalize sometimes what our state, what is still, in the end, a state-to-state transaction. So one, you can have simultaneously societal reconciliation endeavors, and certainly some of the civil society stuff I think is very important, psychologically, et cetera. But I think we are still talking about a state-to-state transaction that can't be about each person's personal experiences. It has to be a little bit more clinical than that at some level.
I, too, was approaching this in terms of analysis versus advocacy. I think if our discussion was on policy recommendations right here and now, we'd have much more disagreement on the panel. What I do want to point out in response to a couple of the last questioners, I did my history PhD at Yale, and we had something called the 30-year rule, which is you really can't do justice to a topic and draw broad conclusions about which you can be sure. If it's on a topic in the last 30 years, because quite frankly, there's often a discrepancy between what actually happened and what's in the popular literature at the time, and so there also has to be that documentary record check. So I'd throw that word of caution out with regard to some of the discussions relating to both the U.S. and the Iranian outreach to each other and so forth. But that's also a call for transparency. I think we classify way too much, and if it doesn't protect sources and methods, it should be out there, at least for the lessons learned part. One of the other issues, which I've disagreed a little bit with some of the panelists, is the idea that nothing else has worked, so we need to try this. One of the problems academically, with the literature about sanctions, with the literature about coercion, and some of the other issues, is that they conclude that, well, these are the weak points of these strategies, therefore engagement and diplomacy must be a better strategy, but there hasn't yet really been a study to look at issues of engagement and diplomacy on its own terms, issues such as political filtering, how information flow in the interagency process differs when you have diplomacy going on, momentum, sincerity, that sort of issue, And the last thing I want to say, and I do think that while John has been highlighting the negotiations, this I want to emphasize, I would hope that this underscores what you're doing, is the whole notion in State Department, military speak of dime. The diplomatic, the information, the military, and the economic. It's hard to separate one out from the context of the others. And so while I think John's work is extremely important in drawing broader policy conclusions from a panel, it also has to be understood that there's going to be other strategies going on simultaneously in the background.
Okay. Well, thank you. I want to thank each of our panelists, John, Muhabbat, Ellen, Michael, for a rich and illuminating discussion. And I want to thank you all as well for your questions and comments, and do stay tuned. His study is a work in progress and will be coming down the pike. Stay tuned.